May it please the court. This is a this single creditor, single asset, involuntary Chapter 7 case was filed by a judgment creditor owed a non-dischargeable debt. The case is of no benefit to the debtor because the debt is non-dischargeable. And
well, if an amount were paid through the bankruptcy, wouldn't that benefit the debtor?
I don't see how, unless the entirety of the judgment were paid.
Well, I mean, if there's a $14 million non-dischargeable debt, if $5 million is paid, there's a $9 million. Isn't that a benefit?
In some sense, that would reduce the debtor's liability.
The arithmetic sense, wouldn't you say?
I would say in some sense that's a fair point.
Not maybe in total.
Not in total.
Okay,
not
maybe.
In total.
Okay, fair enough.
But counsel, it has the possibility, if it was a complete recovery, to wipe out the non-dischargeable obligation.
That's true. There is a possibility, if it was a complete recovery, of not wiping out the non-dischargeable obligation. But
so, it goes from zero to 100%, but there's no detriment to the debtor if there's a recovery.
There's no detriment to the debtor. There is a detriment to the debtor by allowing the case to proceed.
Well, isn't that the debtor's complaint to make? Debtor isn't making that complaint.
The debtor, so this goes obviously to the standing issue, but in terms of the merits of the case, there is a detriment to the debtor in allowing...
Your call to make.
That's on the standing question, that's right. I was talking about it from a policy perspective, which I think is where the merits go here.
So you're talking about...
proper invocation of the bankruptcy code.
Judge Lafferty's point that factually that isn't really how it lines up. You are making an assumption that this is detrimental to the debtor.
I am making an assumption that this is something that the debtor does not want to participate in because I think that assumption is borne out by the record of the debtor's non-appearance and non-participation in this case.
And not willingness to follow the bad faith action.
Right. The debtor has not pursued a bad faith litigation against my client and has not assigned that bad faith litigation.
But isn't it a fair inference equally that the debtor just doesn't care?
I think there is inference that an individual who's under a court order, if someone just didn't care and they were under no, it didn't matter either way, that would be one thing. But when they're under
He hasn't showed up 12 times for 341s.
Right. And that's a violation of his obligations. And he's been obligated to prepare schedules and statements, for example, and he has not done so. So I think if this were a free issue, in the sense that he wasn't subject to any obligation to do something and he just didn't do it, then I would agree that the inference could be either way, that he just doesn't care or that he doesn't want to do something.
But counsel, in a situation where your client is not the one at stake, but where a debtor is refusing to take action to preserve assets, so a creditor of the estate brings it involuntary to preserve that asset for the benefit of the estate, even if it's against the debtor's purposes, even if the debtor doesn't like it, it's still a valid action to bring an involuntary bankruptcy proceeding simply to preserve a cause of action.
Well, I'd respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor, for two reasons. Number one, it's not preserving a cause of action. So the cause of action will be in existence regardless of what happens with this bankruptcy or without this bankruptcy.
But if a recalcitrant debtor refuses to take action to litigate the claim and it could then be barred by the statute of limitations, an involuntary bankruptcy proceeding that puts a trustee in position to exercise that cause of action is a valid use of the bankruptcy code, isn't it?
I'd respectfully disagree, Your Honor, for this reason. The California state rules that we are dealing with.
That protects you. We're talking about the estate here. If it was a fraudulent conveyance claim and the debtor refused to go after the fraudulent conveyance, the transferee doesn't have standing or doesn't have a bad faith argument that it doesn't want to get sued in the bankruptcy court by a trustee because it doesn't want to defend the claim. That's what you're arguing here, essentially, isn't it?
Well, I don't quite think so. So let me take a step back then and talk about the Murphy, not Murray case, the Murphy case, which is the 1976 California Supreme Court case that establishes this rule that this entire involuntary case was designed to get around. So in the Murphy case, it was a very similar situation. We had a plaintiff who was a wrongful death case who sued a tortfeasor for the wrongful death of her son. The tortfeasor was insured by Allstate. Allstate Insurance Company rejected a $25,000 policy limit demand. Ms. Murphy was ultimately awarded a judgment of $42,000, so in excess of policy limits. Allstate paid those policy limits, paid the $42,000, paid the $25,000.
Counsel, the bottom line is, you want to raise that in defense in the state court? You're welcome to do that. You're asking us to dismiss the bankruptcy case, to reverse the order of the bankruptcy judge that found you didn't have standing and found there's nothing untoward about filing an involuntary bankruptcy case. And you're basing it upon your claim that state law wouldn't permit this. Who cares what state law has to do with this situation? We're looking at whether the code and the trustee have the right to proceed. That's all we're concerned about. And whether you have the ability to have the case dismissed. Isn't that what we're concerned with today?
Well, so for today, we are concerned, number one, with standing. I agree with that. And then number two, with the bankruptcy policy issue, which goes to the merits. So if you'd like me to address the standing issue first, I'm happy to do that.
Well, you seem to want to go to bad faith first. But go ahead. Why don't you try standing?
Okay, sure. So on standing, there's two issues. There's constitutional standing, which is, do we have a concrete and particularized injury in fact? Is it traceable to the issue that we're challenging, and would it be redressed by a favorable decision? Here we have a concrete and particularized injury in fact, in the sense that we are a defendant in a state court lawsuit for $14 million that could not have been filed but for the bankruptcy case.
But that right to sue you belongs to the debtor, right?
That is correct. If the debtor
It also could be transferred by the debtor, assigned by the debtor to Wood.
It can be voluntarily assigned, not involuntarily.
But I
the
think
is, that the filing of the bankruptcy case doesn't cause your injury, which is the filing of the lawsuit. That's a determination made by the trustee in the Chapter 7 case, isn't it?
Well, the fact that we are a defendant in a lawsuit that has been brought by a Chapter 7 trustee who could not bring that lawsuit but for the existence of the bankruptcy case means that we have a concrete and particularized injury that is traceable. Now, it may have many traceable facts, right? Something can be caused by many things. So it's true that the bankruptcy could have been filed and the trustee could have said, no, I'm not going to file a lawsuit, right? That would certainly be true. But one factor that is causing our concrete and particularized injury here is the pendency of this bankruptcy case. Absolutely.
Well, I'll try it a little bit different way, because I think I'm saying what I think I heard Judge Gann saying. The bankruptcy doesn't create a cause of action. It's there. What the bankruptcy does is put somebody in place of an inexplicably recalcitrant debtor to do something for the benefit of the creditors of the bankruptcy estate. What is wrong with that? And how does that act by itself give you sin? I mean, I realize there's kind of rim that's going to happen to you. You'd rather not be sued. I understand that. But how does the bankruptcy itself directly affect your standing as opposed to something bad's going to happen down the road?
Because
those are two very different questions.
Right, because California state law, so let's we're talking about the Murphy case, right? The judgment was entered for an excessive policy limit. The plaintiff in the Murphy case said, I want the full judgment, went to the California Supreme Court. They said, no, that ability to sue, the defendant's ability to sue his insurer is something that is assignable to you. If he makes a voluntary assignment, it cannot be levied or executed upon. And the reason it gave was as follows. It said, look, if we allowed plaintiffs to go ahead and just levy and execute on a bad faith claim that's held by the defendant, then those defendants' other assets, they would lose all bargaining power, right? And their other assets would be exposed.
I understand it. The question is whether the bankruptcy, the effect of a bankruptcy filing, is what the Supreme Court was worried about. I'm not convinced it is. You're at your 5 minutes. Would you rather proceed on a reserve your time?
No, I'll reserve my time. Thank you, Your
Honor. Thank you.
If it please the court, although an appellant attempts to obfuscate the issues in order to manufacture an error of law attributable to the bankruptcy court, this case is fairly straightforward. This appellant did not have standing to bring a motion to dismiss this bankruptcy case, didn't have constitutional standing, didn't have prudential standing. They rely almost entirely upon the Murray case. And in the Murray case, there was a decision by the bankruptcy court, by the district court, by the Second Circuit. And although the Murray case went the other way on a set of different facts, really, it was a motion brought by the debtor. It was not by the target of a litigation, which is what we have here. But Murray, all three of those decisions say it's within the discretion of the court. The bankruptcy court here reviewed all of the factors. This isn't merely a recalcitrant debtor. This is a really bad debtor. This is a debtor who ran over this creditor and continued running over him and tried to flee the scene, creating egregious injuries in this creditor.
We're not gonna try the facts. No offense.
Can I
go back to Murray for a second?
Yes.
Can you remind me whether the point of Murray was to not create a cause of action, but create a bankruptcy-specific means of realizing on an asset that would not have been available otherwise?
The asset was already in the bankruptcy estate, Your Honor. It was a tenant in the entirety's case,
right?
Under New York law, the creditor only had the ability to reach part of the estate.
Right.
It affected the value of the asset. And there in Murray, the bankruptcy court said there were other remedies. They had the creditor had a right to a lien. And I know you didn't want to get into the facts, but there's
well, a lot. No, but is it true that part of the disquiet that Judge Gerber had in Murray was bankruptcy is maybe artificially creating a doctrinal outcome here that wouldn't have been available otherwise?
That's true, Your Honor. But I would also
say, I mean, and you would say that's not true here. What's true here is somebody is just substituting in for a party.
That's right. That's right.
It's a doctrinal outcome, right?
Right. The bad faith insurance claim existed, Your Honor, in the debtor. The statute of limitations hadn't passed. So, and the trustee picked it up once and prosecuted it once the order for relief was entered.
So, counsel, even if the bankruptcy case was dismissed, there doesn't prevent the debtor himself, if he wanted to, from intervening in that action and again commencing or completing the prosecution. Or if the case was dismissed, the debtor could assign the claim to Wood, and Wood could intervene in that litigation. In other words, the dismissal of the bankruptcy case doesn't necessarily end the litigation in state court. It just, in the insurance company's view, makes it more likely that it wouldn't proceed. But that's the cause of action is the cause of action. They have no control over the cause of action or whether it gets litigated, right? The insurance company doesn't.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. The debtor would have the option to come in and intervene. I don't know what the statute, all the procedural issues in state court on intervention, but I would think the case wouldn't automatically be dismissed. I'd imagine there would have to be some sort of order to show cause, notice to the debtor about taking it over. So I think that's...
I was just trying to address the redressability question that he was suggesting, that this would in fact mean that they win, and I don't see the relationship necessarily between the dismissal of the bankruptcy case and the existence of the cause of action against them.
That I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
Maybe you could address some of the bad faith, the question of whether this is a bad faith filing, as they've asserted.
Your Honor, there are a number of distinguishing, well, first of all, Murray didn't say it was a bad faith filing. Murray declined to make that ruling, although it did use some strong language. Because of the variety of factors that existed in Murray, the court was found to have discretion within their discretion to determine that dismissal was appropriate. Murray talked about whether 702A was the proper basis to dismiss or whether 303 was the focus. And they did focus on section 702, and that was the part that was that was also affirmed up on appeal, that 702 applies even in involuntary, even before an order for relief was entered. One of the distinguishing factors here, too, is the order for relief was entered 18 months ago. It was entered April 30th, 2019. And here we are, you know, and this is an argument, and the bankruptcy judge agreed with it, that, you know, in the interim, the insurance company didn't do anything until recently. The trustee was appointed, the trustee hired general counsel, the trustee hired special counsel, lawsuit was commenced, we've incurred expenses, we've, you know, tried to force the debtor to appear in the 341A meeting, we got an extension to do that, we filed a complaint, got his discharge denied, we filed schedules, we had to investigate, work with the creditor to prepare schedules. That was all authorized by court orders. Nobody came in and opposed it, even though the carrier was on notice of every one of these items, each of these steps. So there's also a reliance issue coming in 18 months later. Murray was in the involuntary stage before an order for relief. No order for relief was entered in that case. And to challenge a bankruptcy case this far along by the target of the litigation itself, I think that's a wrongful use of the motion to dismiss. Was there a question? I'm sorry.
No.
Okay. Your Honors, the standing issue is important. There has to be constitutional standing. Here there isn't. The requirement is that the appellant have an actual or imminent injury in fact that is directly attributable to the bankruptcy filing, not to the lawsuit, to the bankruptcy filing. Prudential standing is the same thing. They say that they don't even need to be a party in interest. Well, nobody should be allowed to come in off the street and challenge a bankruptcy. They had the opportunity, if they had a right to file if they thought they were owed money, to file a proof of claim. They didn't. They're not the debtor. The debtor didn't come in here and oppose this bankruptcy filing. Again, the debtor is a scoundrel. The trustee submits that this is an appropriate use of an involuntary case. And that it's too late now to be coming in, and administrative creditors have taken action in reliance on a bankruptcy case. There's an argument made in their brief that, well, my firm's employment application said that our engagement was effectively a contingency for our hourly rates. That's true with respect to the contingency of the recovery in the lawsuit. To pull the rug out from under us 18 months later because and challenge it, that wasn't the contingency we signed on for. There was a bankruptcy case, and we acted in reliance on a bankruptcy case. Your Honors, again, the bankruptcy judge was well within his discretion under these facts to dismiss or to deny the motion to dismiss. The judge was correct that the appellant lacked standing, and Your Honors should affirm.
Any further questions?
I don't have any.
Judge Spraker?
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, Mr. Pfister, you've got about 5 minutes, a little under five minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. So let me touch on a few points. First of all, on standing, again, a fact may be caused by many different causes, but the fact of the matter is that my client is a defendant in a litigation where the plaintiff is a bankruptcy trustee, and if the bankruptcy case were to be dismissed, that litigation would go away. Somebody else could bring
that
it.
Mean,
absolutely
does that mean,
true.
Counsel, does that mean that if the debtor voluntarily filed, it would be bad faith?
No, it does not mean that at all. If this is an involuntary case, and this is the use of an involuntary case as a judgment enforcement mechanism.
To which the debtor has not complained.
So that's the standing issue. But the 707 issue, once you have, I agree, you have to have standing. And my point on standing is we are a defendant in a lawsuit that will go away.
But it goes to bad faith too. Because you are saying it's bad faith because you are doing something that shouldn't happen. But the debtor controls the ability to say, to come in here and weigh on that scale and has chosen not to.
So in terms of the debtor's absence, let me say this. I think there's an interesting point to be made here. First of all, Mr. Israel says the debtor's a scoundrel. Well, the debtor in Murray was a scoundrel as well. The debtor in Murray, though, happened to be a well-heeled scoundrel. Who came in and hired counsel, and they made a motion under 305, which obviously is inapplicable or it's an inappropriate way of seeking dismissal given the standard under 305, which is that it has to be in the best interest of all creditors. So what Judge Gerber said was, no, 305 doesn't work. Debtor's a scoundrel, absolutely. But what Judge Gerber said is I have authority under 707A, and 707A is about the integrity of the system as a whole and what is a proper use of the bankruptcy code. And it's not proper here to use the bankruptcy code.
But counsel, isn't really the distinguishing feature in Murray that there was an objection by the debtor who was the involuntary, putative debtor in the case. Number two, his wife, who owned the other part of the property, did not want to have a 363H sale. She didn't want to convey her interest. And that was really what the purpose was, to utilize a provision of the code that otherwise they couldn't force a sale under state law. There's nothing that's changed in your case. The state law contractual obligation under your policy isn't altered by the appointment of a trustee. The defenses that you have are not altered by the appointment of a trustee. The cases that you relied upon, Thorpe and GTI, actually altered the insurance company's defenses, increased their liability. That's what gave them standing. You don't have any of those circumstances present here.
Well, so let me address the wife point, because that point did come up at the bankruptcy court. There is nothing in the Murray decisions, either Judge Gerber's decision, the district court's decision, the Second Circuit's opinion, that talks about Mr. Murray's wife who did not appear in the bankruptcy case. I think that's frankly speculation as to the idea that Judge Gerber was really out to protect Mrs. Murray. But to go back to my point of a second ago, we had a well-heeled scoundrel in Murray who hired counsel who made an incorrect argument. Here we have a debtor who's not a well-heeled individual and may well be a scoundrel, but he's a elderly and non-native speaker of English. Unlike Mr. Murray, who had boats and accounts in the Bahamas and the like, Mr. Venegas does not have those resources, did not hire counsel, did not come in. However, what do we know about whether he wants this case to proceed? We know that he has disobeyed every single court order. He has essentially, as you might say, voted with his feet in the sense of not showing up, and I'm not excusing that conduct.
But
I'm
trying to stand in his shoes to make an argument that the case should be dismissed because he hasn't actively participated. So you're suggesting that proves that you have standing in the case to assert his arguments, which is, I don't want this case to go forward.
I would disagree with that in the sense that I'm not relying on him to say I have standing. I'm saying as that basis for distinguishing the Murray case, what I think that has more to do with is the respective economic postures of Mr. Murray versus Mr. Venegas. My standing is as articulated, which is my client is a defendant in a lawsuit that could not have been brought but for this bankruptcy filing.
Well, can I correct that? It's not couldn't have been brought, wouldn't have been brought.
Was not brought, yeah.
Was not brought, and
it could have been brought, right? That's the point. It was.
Oh, it could have been brought by Mr. Venegas, yes.
Yeah. Or it could have been assigned by Mr. Venegas to Mr. Wood.
That is true. But it cannot have been involuntarily brought against my client by somebody other than Mr. Venegas as a matter of California law. That's the key.
Okay. All right, we're a little over our time. Any last questions from the panel? Okay, thank you. This is a fascinating issue. And by the way, none of this suggests what the outcome is going to be if you actually litigate this in the AP. I understand you have defenses all over the place there, Mr. Pfister. So even if we don't see this your way, I'm sure you'll have many good things to say. The matter's under submission. Thank you both for your very good arguments.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Thank you.